You're listening to The Sound of Language on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
To all of our Is Sound a Language listeners, this is Ashley.
This is Logan.
Today we have a very special guest. We have Petra Floyd. They are a CMU School of Art MFA alumni and multidisciplinary visual and sound artist based in Pittsburgh, PA. We're super excited to be chatting with them this evening. How are you doing, Petra?
I'm okay. I feel like strangely nervous. I was like, wow, I feel like I'm interviewing for grad school again or something. Yeah. But yeah, otherwise, yeah, I feel good.
Amazing. So I wanted to start with a question that you gave us, actually, which is, what is your relationship to hearing and listening as a sense?
Yeah. When I wrote that question, I was thinking about how I'm drawn to working with sound because I have such a strong response to it. I'm someone who has like different sensory issues, something I didn't become more aware of until my adulthood. And so like hearing a slight buzz or things like that, right, would be affecting me emotionally, but I wouldn't know why. I'd be like a little annoyed or a little irritated or something, right? And then I found the word misophonia, and I forget what miso means in that, but phonio, as we know, it's like sound. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, things like someone chewing or having like a, not being able to clear their throat all the way, or honestly just not liking the sound of someone's voice. And be like, I wish I could change that. So that's a way that I became more aware of my relationship to sound as a sense. And I also do some grounding exercises, and you've probably heard this grounding exercise, the like 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 countdown, where it's like, name 5 things that you see, 4 things that you can touch, you know, things like that. And I was finding that that was helpful for me, because as someone who like doesn't drive, for example, I'd be like on the bus or the trolley in Philly, and it'd be like, man, I'm just so agitated and irritated on my commute to work. Like, why am I so angry? Like, yeah, work is hard, but like, this is just extra. And I realized it's because I couldn't control what was happening, like sonically for me. even when you put in headphones, like someone's talking loud, you can hear the groan of the bus, like these different things. I'm talking about how sound, you know, can be a source of like concern for me, but also it's been a great comfort for me. And I would say that listening to a good like DJ set or sound podcast or something and going for a walk when I felt like my loneliness here in Pittsburgh as like a transplant was something that just refreshed my imagination, my outlook on life. And also there have been moments for me where sound has been transformative and I have just been like a weepy mess after like listening to something really good, mm-hmm. you know? So those are some of the things that come to mind for me when thinking about sound as a sense and its impact on me.
And I guess to jump off about your relationship with sound and as a sense, do you consider sound a language?
Yeah, I was so curious about the name of this class and the name of this like podcast because, yeah, there's like lots of different languages. Not all of them are sonic, of course, like written language or like pictorial language. I think sound can be a language. When I think about a language, I think about like a coherent system of some sort that like you can refer to, even if it's just a language of your own, but you can refer back to it after the fact and there still be like a stable enough meaning, you know, that you're calling back to. So yeah, sound can be a language. It kind of feels silly to like be like, can sound be a language when we're literally speaking right now?
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking like, I think about the patterns of life, like waiting at the bus stop, hearing the cars whiz by, hearing two blocks away the sound of the bus beeping, you know? Mm-hmm. And then the bus comes, the doors open, it lowers, you know? There's the beep of me tapping my car. That's a predictable pattern that communicates that I'm on some type of journey. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, why not? Sure.
Well, it reminds me of when, I don't know if you had this experience as a kid, but whenever you're making like an imaginary language or something and there has to be someone else to exchange it with and have a kind of call and response, like the bus in a way becomes that. So you're an artist who makes sound, improvisational performance. How important to you is the act of improvisation, and does it have to be recorded? Does it have to have a life outside of that moment? Or is the kind of special quality of it that it's ephemeral and lives on in those that participated in it?
I mean, I think there can be benefits to recording and also not recording. For example, I went to an improv set last night. There's this really wonderful group called Pittsburgh Sound Preserve. They've run an open improv lab, which has been a really important space for me where, as the name suggests, we improvise. And it's kind of random who you end up improvising with, although there's like a cast of recurring characters, which I'm glad to become one. And I, in the past, have taken out my phone to record. Where I'm like, ooh, this moment is really hitting. Mm-hmm. Like, I need to capture it, maybe because my partner is in a particular improv group and I want them to hear back what happens, you know? Mm-hmm. And in that type of setting, it can be nice to record because sometimes when you're really like catching the spirit and you're just sort of riding the wave, mm-hmm. right? Because you're really plugged in. You're listening to the audience and your collaborators. So it's nice to have something to be like, oh yes, that moment happened. Yeah. Because sometimes I improv with people and I forget who I even improv with. They'll be like, yeah, that was great. And I was like, mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's nice to have the document in that kind of way mm-hmm. for an open improv like that. But last night I just was like, I don't want to record. I want to just be in the moment. You know, mm-hmm. also, I will say, though, it depends on your goals, right? If you want a type of score for yourself to refer back to because you're creating a work or something, then that's great. You can use it to sample, bring it into the next improvisation. But I don't necessarily always have the patience to like go back and listen to the recording. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a few weeks ago, we did an exercise where we thought of either like the first song that we could remember and tried to like locate where it takes us. And so we're curious if there's a sound or a piece of music that you can recall and like where it takes you.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many songs that do that for me, that sent me into a specific place. I will say that there's this one DJ producer named African Sciences. It's African, spelled with a K. And he has this one mix. It's called, he did it for Berlin Community Radio, I believe. And the mix is called Satellite Editions
1.
And well, let's say I took a bath and it was an enhanced bath. And I was listening to, you know, this set before. It helped inspire some artwork I made. It helped me work through a problem I had. Mm-hmm. And then for this enhanced bath, I was listening to it and I connected with my ancestors, and they had some important things to tell me about myself. That musical space that African Sciences constructed for me, when I listen back to it, it's an opportunity to return back to those lessons, that self-knowledge discovered in those moments. I offer that to y'all if you want to listen to something really groovy and good. I will say that sometimes being a person, there's so many different parts of you that you become alienated from or are influenced to think are separate and discrete. And when you're in the practice of making sense of yourself, like in grad school, and presenting that to other people, there's lots of self-editing that happens for me before I even knew it. And something like an African Sciences set is like, no, all of those things, no matter how disparate they seem, even they don't fit neatly into the outline or the brainstorming map or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, this is like the universe of you. These are, you know, these are the various constellations that inform you. And they can all be in the same place. So really impactful music does that for me.
Amazing. Wow. I think talking about graduate school and that experience, a few of us in the program have had a lot of conversations about play and what play means. And we get told to play more in this space. And for some, play is a space of orientation and disorientation, and play requires a kind of safety. So in those kind of confines, what is your relationship to play? And do you see improvisation as play?
Okay, I'm going to need to take that piece
yeah,
by piece.
Sorry.
Yeah, let's start off.
We can break it down.
Yeah, let's break it down. Let's start off with the first piece, please.
What is your relationship to play?
All right.
See? Easy.
Yeah, easy. Who hasn't played? Yeah, my relationship with play.
And did people tell you that during graduate school?
Faculty, you should play more?
Or, yeah.
I don't recall. Maybe they did.
You blocked it out at this point. Yeah.
There's a lot that's like deep within me now. But yeah, I came in interested in play, and imaginative play has been important to me. And then as a young adult, moving in various worlds and methodologies of making art, it was hard for me to think of myself as like a fine artist, but I was drawn to people who were doing things with performance, mm-hmm. and like improvised, devised performance. And we had this play language with each other, because as adults, play becomes either discouraged or it needs to be organized, right? You go to the axe throwing place, you, you know, you buy the video game, you know, but just open-ended imaginative play is something that's very much alive in theatrical spaces, I would say. Yeah. And being in those play spaces helped me realize I still had that intelligence about me because, you know, I'm a neurodivergent person. And one of the things that separates you from the more typical kids or the kids who are masking more is they drop emotional play or imaginative play faster. So like I remember middle school being a little freak with my friends running around, little weirdo squad. You know, I had crushes on my classmates and all the quote unquote age appropriate things. But I wanted to run around and eat weeds and just get worked up and whatever. And that same spirit was present in these devised, improvised theatrical spaces. And that's where I realized that I had my own sensibility, that I had my own intelligence, that I had certain aesthetics I was after. I would go see shows, especially like scratch nights. The idea of a scratch night is works in progress. You present, you just throw up what you have and you get feedback from the audience. And seeing other people play in that way was so exhilarating to me and encouraged me to make my own work. I'm no longer primarily interested in like long form performance or anything like that, but it was a pace of play that was important for me.
Yeah. For you, in your opinion, where does the performance begin and end in play?
Wow. This makes me think about why like TikTok videos are so great. By great, I mean like so impactful for people because like we're watching other people play and some of us take on that invitation to play. Yes, I'm going to do that dance with my friends or I'm going to try this challenge or I'm going to try this recipe or whatever. But we're kind of like the kids on the sidelines being like, oh, I want to do that too. You know, I think there may be those folks who are sort of standing on the sideline who are like, oh, I want to do that too. You know? And like, you may or may not be performing for them. And the question of what performance is just like another can of worms in itself, which is not to say it's like a bad question to ask. But this reminds me of the idea of a performance ending when no one remembers it anymore. But you asked about when a performance starts, right?
Yeah.
So when does the performance start? That I can't answer. I can't answer.
That's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's honesty too. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So one of the readings you shared with us was a Miri Baraka's poem, Rhythm Travel. Baraka describes rhythm travel as a way to move through time via sound. As a sonic artist, do you see parallels between this idea and your own work?
Oh, totally. And I didn't learn about the Baraka poem until pretty recently, like just last year. There's a really good podcast by the artist Santa Gold, and I wish I remember the title. She's in this conversation about Afrofuturism, actually, and one of her guests brings up Amiri Baraka's piece, which is how I found out about it. I love the time travel capacities of sound. And also, like, we talked about play and safety earlier. So, you know, there are so many times when, like, I've shared a particular, we'll say, musical experience with someone and I'm no longer in relation to that person. Like we broke up, our friendship petered off, or we're just in different places. And listening to that song helps me safely encounter them in that relationship again. You know, it helps you like travel within yourself. You know, it's like a costume you can put on. You can either be singing it or just be like, this is the vibe I'm moving in right now, you know. So it's a way to alter your present. Yeah. And like what I said earlier about that African sciences mix, it takes me to these different places, musicians that I will never meet, right? But one of my favorite things too is like listening to an artist that I had no idea about before. For example, Shuggy Otis. And being like, oh, he's like old school Steve Lacy, like, and being like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, seeing the lineage.
Yes, yeah. That's exactly it. Lineage. I think that's one thing that's been so important for me. I will say that being in this type of educational institution, there's an expectation of an awareness of your artistic lineage, right? Who are the people you're calling in through your practice, right? And part of that work hinges upon who you've been introduced to, you know, like who have you been taught, right? And I will say that as a Black artist here in America, most of my educators were white. I can count on one hand, like the Black educators that I had in formal educational contexts. And so learning about my lineages as an artist has required like some active digging and learning myself, like going out and fetching it. When I have been in sound spaces where we talk about sound lineages, like, oh, who sampled whom? And this beat was actually established in this way by these people over here. And then it got sampled by somebody else. And I was like, what a great way to teach history, right? Through songs, right? A lineage of songs. What a great way to bring in different concepts. There's a really wonderful educator and DJ, Susie Analog. And she's like, yeah, this call and response, repetition, you can track this throughout these different musical movements. And just hearing Susie talk about these things made me feel so grounded in my creative endeavors in a way where I felt connected to deep time. Mm-hmm. Not just like, oh, my dad was a musician and therefore I'm interested in sound, but like deep, deep time, you know?
Yeah,
yeah, that's the time travel that has been really important for me.
That kind of leads into this next question of the concept of rhythm travel implies that sound is not just heard, but felt and embodied. And so either in your music listening experience or in your performances, how do you engage with the physicality of sound?
Yeah, let's talk about it. So much of my work right now is figuring it out and making that happen, like making situations where that can happen. So I could talk about my project Audiobolisk. Audiobolisk is a sonic response I've had and have invited other people to join me in, where we're responding to this sculpture by a Pittsburgh artist, Peter Calaboyas. He passed away a few years ago, and he made this piece that's 5 obelisks, metal obelisks. They're situated in Mellon Park on Penn Ave, right near East Liberty. If you're a curious onlooker and you just like tap the sculpture, each of these obelisks resonates so beautifully, right? So they have a voice in their own. For Audiobolisk, what happens is that I, on a whim and a hunch, I was like, I think these can be resonated with transducers. Tactile transducers, if you think about like a video game, I know something might be happening on screen, dramatic, and then your like controller starts to rumble. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's a sort of similar thing where like it's taking that like sonic information and translating it back into vibration. And those vibrations can be used to like rattle your seat or your video game controller, or they can rattle a surface and reproduce the original sound. And so I like learned about that while here in grad school from a really amazing professor, Annie Shea. And I was like, I think I can take this, attach them to this sculpture, and I just want to hear my voice through this sculpture. And I tried it out, and it was so freaky and so cool to feel the sculpture rattle with my voice, right? And then I got to invite other folks to do the same. And we did, you know, improvisations to try out the possibility space, right? Like, what's the possibility space here? What are all the things we can do that are non-damaging, you know, to this sculpture and vibrating it? Thank you. I'd like to do a couple of these, what I call sounding events. Folks from Pittsburgh Sound Preserve have come through, folks from my CMU community, other people I've met around Pittsburgh have come through to participate. And the second time we did this, which was in October, I took the time to actually like hold one of these obelisks while it was being vibrated. And I had never experienced sound like that before, just like going through my body. And even subtle sounds too, not like a sonorous roar or anything, but scratching a microphone with their like stuffed animal. The little hand of the stuffed animal rubbing a microphone, I could feel throughout my body. It's like incredible. I'm interested in that, yeah, that experiential play there.
I had a question about the transducers and these contract microphones that are in direct connection with the surface. And typically, like, the sounds we hear are received as vibrations sent through the air. Do you consider that direct contact with the sculpture that you were describing as like a hyper-hearing or a hyper-sensitivity towards sound?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think of like a hierarchy in like sonic experience or anything. I think there's just a bouquet of possibilities.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about like the sound of my iPad playing back a podcast or a TV show while I'm in the bath, and I listen to it while I'm above water, and then I dunk my head and submerge my body in, and I'm hearing this sort of different experience, right? Of the sound. It's like distant, it's in my head differently. I'm just sort of hungry for those different experiences. Yeah. I'm like omnivorous in that kind of way. One could certainly think of it as a type of hyper-hearing. And I would say, you know, you could get really specific there, right? What aspect of the sound are you isolating or drawing attention to? But so much of it is tied into perception as well, right? Because you could go to a chamber meters below the earth where it's super quiet and you'll hear your voice in a way you probably have never heard before. You know, that could be a type of hyper hearing, as you're saying, or you could be in a weird cave and hear your voice echo in a strange way, right?
Yeah.
It's about like the physical phenomenon of like the how the sound is happening, but also just what level of attention are you able to have to it to sort of filter or let in something different, you know?
Yeah, there's a sort of attunement that comes with ways of hearing and listening, and we're not a bat. We're not a fish. There's so many different ways that other creatures are hearing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really, I mean, it's a very rich field. There's so much to study and learn within it. I'm no expert on anything, but I would recommend reading the book An Immense World by Ed Yong. And that's where he discusses animal senses. And he's such a great narrator. He's a really great science communicator. And so the way he's able to create a bridge between our understanding of the world and the possibility really of understanding an animal's experience of the world has been really like informative for me. So yeah, I would recommend reading that if you really want to like get into the weeds with understanding how different beings perceive sounds. Yeah.
I kind of like what you said, how different beings perceive sound. Going back to the physicality of sound, but also your relationship to sound and music. You are a self-described untrained musician. How do you interact with instruments, and what do you consider an instrument?
Yeah, I love being a self-described untrained musician. It's like, no shade, but you said you're not trained. You didn't finish your piano lessons. So instrument, there's so many meanings of the word instrument. We call things instruments that are also sensors, right? Like a stethoscope is an instrument, right? It helps you like listen. It helps you like sense and perceive the world, right? It's not necessarily something that produces sound on its own, but I enjoy that blurring there because I think of sound as a tool for like orienting and disorienting ourselves in the world. And so for me, just to give myself space to play, I'm like, well, anything can be an instrument, but I do have my own desires about like a type of sound quality or musicality that from the object that I'm working with. And certain objects, it makes sense why they become things that we call instruments. For example, wood, right? Different types of wood are going to resonate differently. And I almost think about it as like the voice of an object. When I realized that that sculpture in the park, if you hit it, it had a voice and it was like really ready to sing, right? Mm-hmm. So different objects have their own like, and materials have their own resonant qualities. And you can collaborate with them. You can work with them. Exploit them, whatever, in order to make certain sound events happen, right? Contact mics can make anything an instrument. You just clip a contact mic to it and suddenly you've got something that's producing sounds that are perceivable and that you can manipulate. You know, you can put that through a system, put it through an amplifier, put it through a mixer and manipulate it and play with it. Put that contact mic in your hair, put in some tinsel. I guess you can't put it in water. You know, but you know, you can work around that and use like a hydrophone. So I really am like, anything is an instrument that is helping me understand my world and its materials sonically. That's what I've been playing around with. But there's some hard facts though. Like if I want to make something that replicates another instrument, if I want to make a thumb piano, I can be free to make it out of whatever I want, but will it make sounds in a predictable way that are readily perceivable? I don't know, depending on what materials I use, right? So yeah, there's lots of adjusting that can happen within there to get towards what you really want.
I've just been thinking a lot about, I guess, your influences, Afro-pessimism specifically, which has been on my reading list for the longest time. So this is actually inspiring me to finally sit down and make it a part of, yeah, my own theory, because right now I'm in grad school. And also to just anti-blackness. And, you know, it makes me think how, like, anti-blackness operates both in the conscious and subconscious. And I'm curious if sound or using sound as performance can be used as a conduit between the audience and the performer. So oftentimes, you know, I feel like anti-blackness, a lot of people might not even know that they are operating within a state of anti-blackness. And so thinking of sound and how it can operate in a frequency that can also inhabit the subconscious, you know, can it be a disruptor of anti-blackness? Can it be used as a disruptor of that?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many practices that are doing the thing that you're curious about, I would say. again, to call back to America's musical traditions, mm-hmm. right? You know, from spirituals to the blues to rock and roll to like rap music to like, you know, gospel, soul, like all these things. You would think, mm-hmm. especially with the blues, where you're literally singing about your troubles right. living in an anti-Black world, you right. know, you think that this would maybe disrupt anti-Blackness. But mm-hmm. no, the industry uses anti-Black economics to exploit mm-hmm. the blues musician, right?
Right.
You know, like, so I don't want to think of sound as like capable of doing magic or something mm-hmm. in that kind of way. I would love it if it were as easy as just like playing a certain tone, mm-hmm. like a dog whistle, like tone where like someone's just like going off or is about to do something that they, you prefer that they not do. And it just mm-hmm. sort of gives them some pause, right? Mm-hmm. Like that'd be a fun experiment. And I'm sure there's someone in the lab somewhere that's working on something like that, right? We know that sound impacts behavior.
Yeah.
And there's also like the sound of anti-Blackness, not just in speech, mm-hmm. right? But there's like an article, it was someone saying like, why is gentrification so quiet or something like mm-hmm. that? And it was a quote unquote like native born and bred New Yorker who knew that a neighborhood was changing when its soundscape changed. And the author kind of explores their own ambivalences about like the sonic changes, because sound is many things. It's also classed, it's racialized. And like I would say for me, right, like I live in an apartment in Friendship, which is a quaint little neighborhood in Pittsburgh, not too far from here. And my building, generally fairly quiet. And I had a new neighbor that moved in, and she and her family were much louder than my previous neighbors. And I was just kind of like, am I being anti-Black? Mm. Because like this person is too loud for me, you know, mm. like, and I can hear all of her conversations. And I mean, part of that's that like we're living this like under renovated apartment with really thin walls, you know, so like we're just in each other's space in that kind of way. But then there's also kind of a comfort too, that like her presence indicated for me that like I don't have to be a certain type of person to live in this building. You know what I mean? So the question that you've presented, it's really deep, you know, it's super deep. A whole book could be written right. about it. but these are some of the things that come to mind for me about how sound is racialized and how, like, despite the good work that people have been doing for centuries with sound, sound doesn't necessarily automatically change minds and hearts. Sound doesn't happen in a vacuum. and so it's like, what else has happened in a person's life? Mm-hmm. You may listen to the music, but are you building relationships with people? Do you have a curiosity about the people in your life? Do you have a curiosity about yourself and your own behaviors mm-hmm. and the things that you've taken for granted? And maybe you can bond over sound. But yeah, I don't think it's like a magic trick.
I also wanted to ask about Afro-pessimism versus Afro-futurism. And who did these serve in a power structure or system? How do you kind of navigate both of those terms?
I think that's a good question. And honestly, I haven't engaged much with Afro-pessimism with my theoretical hat on in a while, not since writing my graduate thesis. And even then, you know, it's an ongoing conversation, of course. There's a lot of different terms thrown around. It's like Afro-pessimism. There's like Black optimism. There's all these different words. There's like Afro-surrealism, you know, Black quantum futurism. There are all these ways people have been working to understand and share knowledge about the systems that we are under. Yeah, the ways that anti-Blackness occurs, right? I mean, there's even the conversation around like critical race theory, right? Where it's like, hey, actually this stuff is baked into the laws, you know? So yeah, I haven't like engaged with the academy in that way in a while to talk about Afro-pessimism with, in a sense that feels like fresh and current and like I know who the quote unquote players are. But from what I recall, like the conversation being a few years back is some folks being like, we can't just focus on the terrible things that have happened. There has to be more. Honestly, I think it's people being like, what gives me a reason to wake up, you know, tomorrow morning? You know, does Afro-pessimism make me feel excited to wake up and do my day and be creative and make work? For some people, the answer is yes. For some people, it's no, right? Everyone has their own sense-making project. And with like Afrofuturism, okay, well, I don't know who made up the term Afro-pessimism. I don't know if it was Frank Wilderson and his colleagues, but I will tell you that the term Afrofuturism was created by a white scholar, not a black scholar. And that's interesting, right? I'm forgetting his name. I feel like it's Mark something. It's a term that quickly helps your audience, whoever you're talking to, kind of place you somewhere. But like the destination shouldn't be predetermined by that name, right? Because I could be making Afrofuturist work that still engages with the past, that engages with enslavement and colonialism and empire. I could be doing that work and still be thinking about a future. So yeah, I know that definitely the terms have been put into opposition, and that people may have their like theoretical camps and sort of figuring it out. Sometimes I'll dip and dabble and sprinkle a little Afrofuturism on my stuff if I just want to just be like, this is what it is, art and technology. Let's go, you know. But I would really like to, find a term that feels like home for me, or just be happy like not having a specific home and just borrowing from these different discourses because they have different things to teach me.
Yeah, so going back to your thesis, in your thesis you speak of or bring up the concept of withness.
Mm-hmm.
What does working with an audience generate for you? What has surprised you, shocked you, kept you going?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Oh my goodness. Yeah, so I bring that up in the thesis, withness. Sonia Karana, shout out. I brought that up in the thesis because I was really struggling with my relationship to audience. It was this thing of having what felt like incompatible compulsions, whereas like, I want to make work that's performed in front of people, but I don't want to be perceived. So how do I get through this? Like, I'm so scared about like the lack of control I have and being perceived, but like the thing I want to do can only happen with other people. Because I have questions about play. I have questions about how we're socializing. I have questions about how we're making sense of present day events. I have questions about like how we process information in our bodies, right? I want to know more than what's going on in my head. So withness for me has been a way through, and I talked about like clowning as well, and like the idea of like sharing breath, right? And that being this sort of like exchange, I don't know if it's always an equitable exchange, but there's an exchange where like I mentioned before, there's a people looking in and be like, I want to play too, or like, oh, what's going on over there, right? The kids kind of looking in and judging but also wondering, right? There's something about offering possibilities for other people and therefore offering more possibilities for yourself that comes with acknowledging a withness. I think also it helped me articulate the type of performances I felt less comfortable with, where it felt like a performer was just shutting me out so they could do their compulsion in front of me. And it felt like non-reciprocal in a way, right? And often, you know, that's a feeling one can have as an artist. And yeah, sometimes you do want to see like someone freak out and be like, wow, I didn't know I could do that. I guess that's possible. And other times it's like, I didn't ask for that. I wanted some mystery, you know? And I would struggle within myself because it's like, is this like my latent Christianity coming out right now? Like there's a conservatism I'm having right now about what's above board or not. And some people are just doing too much, you know? So what's the difference between that experience where I want to run out of the room and experience that like deeply like shakes me and affects me? And I've been in situations where I'm on the side of, I love this artwork that's really challenging and messed up because it takes us to a place that we normally don't go to. And I remember discussing this work, piece by my friends, Jennifer Kidwell and her collaborator, Scott Shepherd. And I was working on the show, helping out with props and some other things here and there. And I was talking to this Black elder about the show, and she was like, just disgusted with the show. Why would you want to produce an image of that, right? It's almost like the Afro-pessimism, Afro-futurism conversation. Why do you want to dwell on that? Why would you create images like that? I remember kind of being like, yeah, I get why this would upset you, but like, I'm not you. And there's a type of witness that I could have because I knew the performers. I got to know them. But even before I got to know them, they were with me in experience that I had had. Sometimes you feel these bodily echoes of a history that you could have actually experienced, or a history that could have been an ancestral experience, or stories you've heard from family members or something like that. And when you have a witnessing experience that transports you to that moment and allows you to process it in real time, and the performer does that in a way that's effective, it can be so transformative. So I'm thinking about it, obviously, I'm thinking about it as an audience member and as a performer. And also, I will say that there's ways in which people consume our bodies, period. Like, all, you know, anybody who works, their body's being consumed in some kind of way. But as like an artist, especially in the age of like Instagram, I'm a millennial. I'm not an elder millennial, but, you know, probably 35. And seeing how people use their bodies for their practice by being like cute or interesting on social media. And the body may be literally in the work, but it could also be like what's giving context to the work. All that consumption just was really messing with my head. And also like being in grad school during the Zoom times, you know, hyper perception, hyper surveillance, you know. So yeah, I really had to figure out for myself, how can I be okay with people looking at me? And they're not just looking at me. They're like ideally sharing space with me. And I get to create rules around that. I don't have complete control, but I do get to structure that exchange. And ideally, it feels good. I want performing to feel good. I just want performing to feel good and feel good for the audience. And maybe that means I just don't make work that's very interesting or risky. But like, I want it to be accessible and for there to be so many different ways in for people.
I mean, like, even the act of making an audio-based thesis is a way of making accessible. Because I mean, communication or conversation. For me, when you shared your thesis, I listened to it in my headphones. And so it was kind of directly pumped into my ears. And like we've talked about, there's kind of this sound canceling that happens. So there was nothing else but you kind of being pumped in. And it was a rather intense experience to kind of sit, close my eyes, listen, and consume your thoughts and your ideas, and really exciting. So,
yeah, thank you for describing that. I'm past the point of feeling like stressed out when someone says that they listen to it. I'm like, oh, but right, that's a way of practicing witness where like you're not seeing my body because of how I recorded it, kind of accidentally. Like it's like, okay, we're sharing. Yeah, there's like this is a bodily awareness that's being shared, which is cool. Thank you.
I mean, something that has also kind of come up in this conversation that was touched on by other classmates is this text by Audre Lorde that you quote, which is about the erotics of the audience and the uses of the erotic and the erotics as a bridge. One of our classmates wanted to ask, what are some of your everyday erotics?
Let's see. I will say that a couple weeks ago, I worked on an install at the Science Center, and it was very physical. You know, I was being like Butch Barbie, like so buff, and I loved it after a period of being, you know, very sedentary during the winter. So it was like, I'm hauling around huge movable walls on a pallet jack. I am like using my hands to put things up. I'm like running cable. I'm figuring out what tools I need to like accomplish something. I learned how to safely use a scissor lift, and I was really feeling like in my body. And because of the work schedule, like I had a particular routine, be there at 8, so we'd have our first break at 10, then have our break at 12, and then break at 3. And it put me into this kind of routine, an awareness of myself. And I really enjoy.
When Trump Trump started issuing his executive orders, I saw universities start scrubbing their language without being asked. I saw universities start deleting environmental justice. First off, I was pretty proud, actually, that as a movement, we've gotten to a place where there is a president trying to erase us from history. I don't want to carrot my way into compliance with people who are trying to kill us, because in our